Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are focusing on a field that's really been under the scientific microscope lately: manual medicine and manipulative therapies. We've got some pretty solid sources for this one. We're looking at guidelines from the International Federation for Manual Medicine, FM, and then a whole stack of recent systematic reviews, RCTs, you know, the gold standard stuff, mostly from 2020 right up to 2025. So our mission today is really to sift through all this data. What actually works according to the evidence? Why is the research in this area sometimes, well, complicated? And what are the big professional groups advising practitioners now?
Yeah, and it's probably best to start with what we mean by evidence-based medicine, EBM, in this specific context. The definition they use is pretty clear. It's about the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of the best current evidence. But crucially, it's integrated with clinical experience and the patient's own values.
Okay.
It's definitely not about just following a recipe or a checklist. But, I mean, what EBM does demand is a much higher standard of proof, way more consistent than what was maybe acceptable a few decades back.
It really forces the whole field to evolve and, you know, rigorously test its own basic assumptions.
Okay, let's unpack that evolution then, because the sources do trace how manual medicine developed, right? From the mid-20th century onwards. It seems like it started with individual therapists, highly skilled people, but now it's much more about these national and even international scientific societies.
Exactly.
And it sounds like they built this whole scientific structure almost deliberately to meet those EBM criteria we just talked about.
Yeah.
Like they're driving the professional standards from the inside.
That's a perfect way to put it. And that professionalization, it really hinges on understanding the hierarchy of evidence. The sources mention systems like the AHRQ recommendations. So at the very bottom, level 4V, you've got expert consensus, you know, opinions agreed on in meetings, published proceedings. That's a starting point.
But not where you want to end up, presumably. Not at all. To move up, you need more rigor. Level 3 involves non-experimental studies, like case control or cohort studies. Level II needs good quality non-randomized trials. And then you get to the top, the real gold standard for proving if a treatment works, level MN. That's your large, well-designed, randomized controlled trials, RCTs, and the meta-analyses that combine them.
It's a good reminder, though, that EBM isn't only about RCTs. I mean, our sources bring up something really interesting. Before you can even test a treatment, you need evidence-based diagnostics. They mention needing good reproducibility, validity, sensitivity, specificity studies. You can't really trust the treatment results if clinicians can't even agree on who has the problem in the first place. Right?
That's absolutely the core challenge. And the FAN Scientific Committee, they tackled this head on. They developed this specific thing called the Reproducibility Protocol.
Okay.
They even called it a cookbook format, which is kind of funny. It uses something called Kappa statistics.
Whoa, hold on. Kappa statistics sounds a bit technical. Can you break that down for us? What is that, simply?
Sure. Think of it like this. Kappa measures agreement beyond chance. So if two practitioners examine, say, the same patient's spine, and they both conclude the restriction is at L4, Kappa tells you how much they agree. Better than just random luck.
Oh, okay.
This protocol gives clinics a standard way to measure if their own practitioners are consistent, if they're getting the same diagnostic results reliably. It's about internal quality control.
That makes total sense. So they've done the work to try and make diagnostics reliable. With that foundation, what's the general picture? What does the overall research say about manual medicine now?
Well, if you look at that big systematic review by Bayer and colleagues, they pooled data from 67 publications. The conclusion was that there's a general EBM level 3 evidence base available for manual medicine overall.
Level 3. So good comparative studies, non-experimental data. That sounds respectable. But is that the angle or just where they've managed to get to so far?
It's more like the baseline they've solidly established through all this effort.
Mm.
It means they're past the stage of just anecdotes or theories. There's consistent data suggesting effects.
Okay.
The really exciting part, though, is that specific studies for specific conditions or techniques are breaking through to higher levels. We're seeing level 2 and, importantly, level IB evidence emerging.
Right. Let's ground this in those level IB examples, because that's where things get really convincing, isn't it? Give us a couple of strong level IB findings.
Okay, first one, low back pain, LBP. A level IB study showed a really clear, measurable difference between people with LBP and those without, specifically in how well they could actively control their lower back movements.
How did they measure that?
They used a set of specific tests, 6 of them. And in 5 out of those 6 tests, the LBP group showed a significant deficit in motor control. That provides objective evidence of a functional problem that, you know, manipulation might target.
Okay, that's specific. What's another one?
The second one is pretty impactful. It's about infant care. They studied just over 200 infants between 14 and 24 weeks old who had postural and motor asymmetries, basically. They weren't holding themselves or moving symmetrically.
Right.
And they found that a single manual medicine treatment significantly improved those asymmetries. They measured it using a standardized 4-item score. That's really powerful level I evidence for a very specific application.
Wow. A single treatment in infants showing measurable change. That's strong.
Now, zooming out again, there was that huge review on prognostic factors you mentioned, over 48,000 people involved. What did that tell us about predicting who gets better?
Yeah, that was massive. It helped pin down generic factors that predict outcomes across most musculoskeletal pain conditions you see in primary care.
And what were those factors?
Things like high initial pain intensity, pain being widespread rather than localized, high levels of functional disability, meaning the pain really interferes with daily life. Also, somatization.
Which is when psychological distress shows up as physical symptoms. Exactly. And just general restriction in movement. Knowing these factors helps clinicians sort of triage patients, maybe predict who might need more intensive or different kinds of care packages.
Okay, so moving from who gets better to what actually makes them better. Let's talk treatment effectiveness. Neck Pain First, the Optimo collaboration update, had some pretty direct advice.
They did. Very clear. They concluded that mobilization, manipulation, specifically the HVLA or high velocity, low amplitude thrust techniques, the ones often with the pop sound and clinical massage, are effective for neck pain.
Effective compared to what?
Compared to minimal treatment or sham interventions. But just as importantly, they also listed things that were found not to be effective and therefore should probably be abandoned.
And what's on that avoid list?
Electroacupuncture, a specific technique called strain counterstrain, just general relaxation massage as distinct from targeted clinical massage and several passive modalities.
Like heat packs and ultrasound.
Exactly. Heat, cold, diathermy, hydrotherapy, ultrasound. The evidence just wasn't there for those specific passive treatments, according to this review.
Okay, clear guidance there. Now the big one. Low back pain. You mentioned a specific double-blinded RCT earlier, comparing spinal HVLA manipulation against a standard drug for acute LBP. What was the outcome there?
Right, that was a key study. It showed that the spinal HVLA manipulation was significantly better than taking the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug diclofenac, at least in a subgroup of patients with acute non-specific LBP.
Better than a standard medication?
In that subgroup, yes. And also clinically superior to a placebo intervention within that same group. The fact that a physical therapy outperformed a standard drug, even in a subset of patients, is a really important piece of evidence.
And if we pull back and look at the broader systematic reviews across different conditions, what's the general consensus on efficacy?
The overall weight of evidence, looking across many studies, suggests that spinal manipulation, mobilization, acupuncture, and massage treatments are generally more effective for neck or low back pain than doing nothing, getting a placebo, or just receiving usual care.
Okay.
And specifically for the HVLA procedures, there's also evidence showing they can be cost effective, especially when they're used alongside GP care, advice, and exercise.
And it's not just the spine, right? I saw something about TMJ disorders, jaw pain.
Yes, for TMJ disorders too. The evidence suggests musculoskeletal manipulations are effective and actually show a greater effect compared to other conservative approaches for jaw pain and dysfunction.
But there's always a but, isn't there? Even with all this positive evidence, you mentioned a limitation within the studies themselves that makes things a bit muddy.
That's right. It's a really significant point, actually. Across many, many studies, there's this frequent lack of clear distinction between manipulation, the quick thrust, and mobilization, the slower, gentler movements.
Why does that matter so much?
Well, they likely work through different mechanisms or at least have different neurophysiological effects. If studies lump them together or don't clearly define which one was used, it dilutes the results. We can't be as precise about what exactly is causing the effect.
Which brings us right to the mechanism question. How does this stuff actually work? The newer research, 2020-2025, seems to be digging into the neurophysiology, moving beyond just thinking about joints clicking.
Exactly. The focus is shifting quite a bit towards the neural effects. For instance, a 2024 RCT showed that just a single session of lumbar SMT spinal manipulative therapy significantly increased the pressure pain threshold near the hip, the PSIS area.
Meaning patients could tolerate more pressure before feeling pain.
Correct, compared to a sham treatment. And these effects, this reduction in pain sensitivity, lasted for up to 30 minutes after the treatment. That points towards real-time modulation of pain signals, likely involving both peripheral nerves and central nervous system processes.
And it's not just pain signals changing, is it? I thought something about actual brain activity changes too. This kind of undermines the idea that the audible pop is the critical part.
It does seem that way. There's experimental work using EEG, measuring brain waves. It showed changes consistent with cortical relaxation responses following a thoracic thrust manipulation.
Okay.
The really fascinating part, these brain changes happened whether or not there was an audible cavitation, the pop. This strongly suggests the therapeutic effect, at least partly neurophysiological, isn't dependent on that joint sound.
So the sound might just be a side effect, or maybe even a psychological component, but not the core mechanism.
It seems plausible.
Mm.
And speaking of the psychological side, this links nicely to the biopsychosocial model. There was an RCT looking at people with lumbar disc herniation.
Right.
And it found manual therapy didn't just improve the physical stuff like pain and mobility. It also led to improvements in psychological outcomes, things like anxiety, depression, and kinesiophobia.
Kinesiophobia. That's the fear of movement causing more pain or damage, right?
That's the one. It's a huge barrier in chronic pain. If people are scared to move, they often get stiffer and more disabled. So finding that manual therapy can help reduce that fear alongside the physical benefits is really important. It tackles both sides.
So with all this accumulating evidence on effects and mechanisms, what does it mean for actual clinical practice? The 2023 WHO guideline on chronic primary low back pain seems like a key indicator here.
It is. The WHO guideline is quite definitive. It recommends manual therapy, and it specifically includes SMT and massage. But, and this is the crucial part, only as part of a multimodal package.
Not as a standalone treatment for chronic LBP.
Correct. For chronic primary low back pain, the strong recommendation is integration. Manual therapy alongside exercise and patient education. The evidence supports the package deal, not the isolated technique for these chronic cases.
Okay, now let's get into the really fresh evidence, the 2020-2025 findings, because it seems there are some nuances, maybe even conflicting signals, depending on if we're talking acute versus chronic pain.
There definitely are nuances. For example, a very recent 2025 Cochrane overview looked at acute and subacute low back pain. Their conclusion was that SMT probably makes little to no difference compared to a placebo in the short term for these groups.
Really? No difference?
Little to no significant difference on average in the short term, according to that specific high-quality overview. It suggests that for those acute-subacute patients, maybe things like exercise and psychologically informed approaches give clear benefits.
But then conversely, for chronic pain, the picture looks different. It sounds like selecting the right patients becomes really important.
Absolutely. A 2024 placebo-controlled RCT did find that SMT was superior to a sham treatment for reducing pain in chronic low back pain patients. But the key finding was that this benefit was seen particularly in selected patients who were predicted to respond well.
So not everyone, but for the right person with chronic pain, it can make a real difference.
Exactly. It supports this idea of patient stratification. The average effect across everyone might be small, but if you can identify likely responders, the benefit can be clinically meaningful. We see similar patterns for neck pain conditions too, like cervicogenic headaches or radiculopathy. Specific techniques, like SNAGs.
What are SNAGs again?
Sustained natural apophyseal glides. They're a type of gentle, sustained joint mobilization technique. These specific approaches show benefits for certain neck conditions, although the level of certainty in the evidence can vary.
Okay, so as we try to pull all this together, we have to address some practical caveats. If EBM demands better evidence, we need to be critical about the tools clinicians actually use. That critical review on palpation sounded, well, pretty damning.
It was quite sobering. That 2021 review basically concluded that static palpation, just feeling the spine when it's still, and motion palpation, feeling it as it moves, have generally poor inter-rater reliability for the lumbar spine.
Meaning two different clinicians often don't agree on what they feel.
Pretty much. And beyond just disagreeing, the review also found limited validity, meaning palpation wasn't great at actually identifying the specific spinal level causing the symptoms or the precise pain generator.
That's a fundamental issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
If the primary diagnostic tool has reliability problems, how confident can we be that the treatment is being applied to the right spot or for the right reason?
It's a huge challenge for the field, and it certainly fuels the push towards incorporating more objective assessment tools alongside clinical judgment.
Makes sense. And the other big caveat is always safety. People worry, especially about neck manipulation. What's the latest understanding on adverse events?
The overall message from the evidence is still largely reassuring. Most adverse events linked to spinal manipulation are minor and temporary, like feeling sore or stiff for a day or two. Mm-hmm. Serious adverse events are statistically very rare.
But they do happen.
They do, though, extremely infrequently. Mm-hmm. Recent work mapping studies from 2024 to 2025 has been cataloging these serious events, mostly vascular issues like stroke or arterial dissection, particularly after cervical manipulation.
So the risk isn't zero.
The absolute risk is incredibly low, but it's not zero. And that just underscores how vital it is for clinicians to do thorough screening for any red flags, to have proper conversations about risks and benefits, shared decision-making, and to get informed consent. These steps are non-negotiable.
So bringing it all home, what's the final takeaway for you, our listener, from this deep dive into the current evidence? Where does manual medicine stand today?
I think the weight of the current evidence, especially from 2020 onwards, strongly supports manual medicine, but primarily as an effective component within a broader multimodal care plan.
Integrated care again.
Yes, especially when it's combined with exercise and patient education. The effect sizes, when you average them across large, mixed groups of patients, are often small to moderate. But the evidence is also clear that you can get larger, more clinically significant benefits in specific subgroups, particularly those responders with chronic LBP, if you can identify them.
So the focus needs to be on designing that whole package, selecting patients carefully, and ensuring they stick with the plan.
Exactly. Care package design, patient stratification, and adherence seem to be where the real gains are.
Okay, so the bottom line seems to be, manual therapy isn't a magic bullet, but when used intelligently as part of a complete approach targeted to the right person, it offers measurable benefits that seem grounded in real neurophysiological mechanisms.
And maybe a final thought to leave you with, building on that challenge of diagnostic reliability we talked about.
Okay.
Since we know traditional palpation has limitations, and the sources mention this growing interest in objective measurement tools, mm-hmm. things like the Myoton Pro device to measure muscle properties, or even using telehealth for remote MSK assessments.
Yeah.
Well, you might consider how these new technologies could potentially be the key. Could they help overcome the variability of human assessment, improve diagnostic reliability, and ultimately make these manual treatments, which we know can be effective, even more targeted and consistently successful?
How technology might help solve the human variability puzzle in diagnostics. That's a fascinating place to end. Thank you for walking us through all that complex evidence. We hope this deep dive leaves you feeling much more informed about where manual medicine stands today.